Obviously, we're going to start with Amendment 23. After I have a few opening remarks, I'm going to turn this over to Dr. Cornan for her presentation. So kind of the ground rules for today, they're going to be the same that we use all the time regarding public process and public participation. At the conclusion of the presentation, or if there are breaks in the presentation for questions, we're going to go questions from the council members first, then out to the audience for questions only. There will not be advocating during this questioning time. If you have a narrow question on one of the presentations, that's going to be allowed, but this is not going to be advocating throughout the question and answer process. At the conclusion of the presentation, we will entertain motions, and then and when there is a motion pending, then we can advocate. We'll go out to the audience first, advocate for the content of that motion. Again, those are the rules we followed the entire time that I've been chairman, and those are the rules that we will consistently follow today. Before we get into the presentation, I just wanted to offer a couple of my individual thoughts as chairman regarding the Amendment 23 issue and the debate that will be forthcoming. I've been the chairman of the council for this is the start of my fifth year, and I've been on the council for 8 years, and this is the most divisive issue that I have been involved in. It has pitted friends against friends and council members against council members. There seems to be threats of lawsuits at every turn from both sides of this issue. I frankly also think there's been, in many instances, a lack of respect for other people's points of view on this issue. Where I sit, I see there are two polar opposite views to this issue, the no action side and the 100% monitoring side. And there has been really very limited discussion of trying to find a middle ground or a sweet spot that acknowledges that there should be more accountability, but at the same time appreciates that the ability to pay of industry is limited in some instances. I was hoping that through the Groundfish Committee process, we would have found a middle ground. But unfortunately, that's not the case. Despite attempts to get the information in front of the Groundfish Committee and a preferred alternative, that has not occurred. So literally, we have no motions from the committee today to take up. You know, certainly over the last 48 hours, there have been various proposed motions that have been popping up. In fact, I got three of them sent to me last night. I only wish that these ideas were brought forth earlier so they could have been discussed and reviewed by the Groundfish Committee. In conclusion, I hope that through our debate today, we can find a true middle ground that recognizes the need for accountability, as well as the true inability to pay by some people in the industry. I firmly believe that no is not one of the options on the table today. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Cornan to start her presentation.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will cover what Terry Alexander was going to cover while he reconnects to power. First off, the committee's been quite busy since the June council meeting. The committee has met twice, including an additional meeting of the TMGC. We've had three advisory panel reports. Two of those were the Groundfish Advisory Panel, and one of which was the Recreational Advisory Panel. We've had five Groundfish Plan Development Team meetings, including one on Monday. And all of this has supported a lot of committee work, not only on the amendment, but other topics. But really, we're going to focus this morning on part one of the Groundfish Committee report, which is Amendment 23. And before I turn it over to Robin for her presentation, I want to walk through the plan for the presentation, questions, and then guide you through the discussion document a little bit later this morning. First, we'll have a presentation that covers the council's preliminary preferred alternatives. Those are the ones that you selected at a previous meeting, identifying those. And then after that, walking through the summary of all the public comments received, those we received both at our webinars, at our in-person hearing, as well as through our extended comment period. At the conclusion of that, Robin will walk through some follow-up analyses and provide an opportunity for the council to ask questions about the presentation. When that question period is over, we'll walk through the decision document. Hopefully folks have had a chance to look at that decision document, which not only documents the council's plan for the day on page 2, but also walks through section by section where there have been recommendations on preferred alternatives, both by the council earlier and the Groundfish Advisory Panel members. At the conclusion of which, we'll be looking for motions from council members. As the council chair mentioned, there are no preferred alternative motions from the committee. So we'll be looking for the council to work through this with us today and all 7 action items that you'll see on page 2 of that decision document. So if there aren't any questions about the plan, I would turn it over to Robin to go through the presentation.
Thank you, Jamie. Can everyone hear me okay?
Yes.
Great. Sherry, next slide, please. So as Jamie outlined, the first part of part 1 of the Groundfish report today on Amendment 23, providing an overview of the alternatives with a focus on the council's preliminary preferred alternatives selected in January. Any of the recommendations, again, noting there were none from the committee, there were some recommendations on specific alternatives from the advisors. Next slide, please, Sherry. So the Groundfish Advisory Panel and the committee met last week. As was noted, there were no committee recommendations on any of the final preferred alternatives. There were actually no committee motions that passed at all, though the committee did discuss a couple of the motions that had come through the advisors, but you will note on the following slides that go through the alternatives that there are some recommendations from the advisors on specific alternatives, as well as the advisors had a motion related to recommending to the committee that the council remand the DEIS back to further evaluate some of the alternatives in connection to the purpose of need. And for that reason, they did not recommend a recommendation for the coverage level option. Next slide, please, Sherry. So just a reminder for everyone, in the developing the Amendment 23, the goal that the council set was really to focus on improving catch accounting, the focus on improving accountability and reliability of catch reporting in the commercial groundfish fishery, the intent being to maximize the value of the collected catch data and minimizing the costs. And just to remind everyone, this action focuses on the groundfish industry funded monitoring program. It is not considering any changes to the Northeast Fisheries Observer Program, which is the federally funded NEFOP program. And so that, as you'll see in the next slide, slides going through the alternatives, the council developed the alternatives with this goal of focusing on improving catch accounting in the commercial groundfish fishery. Next slide, please, Sherry. So shown here can be thought of as the overall decision tree for all of the alternatives in Amendment 23. So this sort of takes the alternatives as laid out in the DIS, presents them in a slightly different manner to show how, when considering updates and revisions to the commercial groundfish monitoring program, you can consider changes to a couple of different components to it. So on the left shown, there have been decisions made to look at improvements to at-sea monitoring, and a variety of decisions related to that. On the right-hand side, the council has a decision whether to consider a dockside monitoring program for the entire commercial groundfish monitoring program. And there are also alternatives shown at the bottom that's sort of they're found later in the list of alternatives as presented in the draft document that relate to both programs, considering whether there should be situations where vessels are removed from those monitoring program requirements. And then throughout the in both of those sections for at-sea and dockside monitoring, you'll see there are some administrative measures related to administration of those programs. Next slide, please, Sherry. So shown here are the at-sea monitoring alternatives. These, as a reminder, these are applied to sector monitoring only, and all of these would be target coverage levels that combine the NEFOP coverage with the at-sea monitoring or ASM coverage. So here highlighted in red, you'll see the preliminary preferred alternatives that were selected back in January from the council. And then with the yellow stars, you'll see the advisors' recommendations. So the first decision point the council will be making today in considering updates to the ATSI monitoring program would be considering what to select for the ATSI monitoring standard or the target coverage level that sectors would be required to meet. So all this this is falling under section 4.1, and this is 4.1.1 is the ATSI monitoring standards section of the document. There are three options here, no action being maintaining the 30% CD standard, which has resulted in a variable coverage rate each year. And then two different options for a fixed rate of coverage, option two being a fixed percentage of trips for sector trips that would be covered. And then there are the four sub options for different coverage levels below that, as well as option three, which is the percentage of catch with those same four sub options. And so as a preferred alternative, I'm sure you're all aware that the council selected 100% monitoring of sector trips as its preferred. The advisors selected as a preferred the option two, so to have a fixed rate of coverage as a percentage of trips, but they did not select a recommendation, or they did not have a recommendation for the specific coverage level, the sub option within that option two. The next decision point related to ATSI monitoring to consider in the alternatives is whether to allow additional ATSI monitoring tools. That these would be options for a sector to choose to use instead of a human ATSI monitor. The first option, option one, is using electronic monitoring in place of human ATSI monitors at whatever coverage rate is selected, so sort of a one for one. And then the two preferred alternatives, preliminary preferred alternatives shown, option two is the audit model of electronic monitoring when the cameras run on 100% of trips. And then there's a VTR reported discards are verified through the EM video. And then option three is the maximized retention model of electronic monitoring. The cameras also run on 100% of the trips. And then all of the allocated groundfish are retained. So the camera is verifying that groundfish are not discarded. And then there's a dockside monitoring component that verifies the catch back at the dock. Those are both, again, preliminary preferred alternatives, and the advisors recommended those as alternatives, as final alternatives as well. The advisors did have a note related to max retention that they wanted to note that this option has not been, there's not been guidance that it's approved as a model, and it's not sure when that would be complete as far as approving it as a model of EM to use in the fishery. And then finally, a decision point related to ATSI monitoring that occurs in a later section of the document 4.5, looking at management uncertainty buffers, but it's specifically related to the decision if the council were to select 100% coverage, then it has this option to consider eliminating the management uncertainty buffers. This is for the sector ACLs for allocated groundfish stocks, and this was selected as a preliminary preferred alternative by the council, but there's not a recommendation from the advisors on this section. Next slide, please, Sherry. So then looking at the dockside monitoring section of the alternative, so this is section 4.2 in the document. The council is considering whether to establish a dockside monitoring program that would apply to the entire commercial groundfish fishery, so sectors in the common pool at 100% coverage. So that is the first decision point to be made, and then all of the decision points shown here below that would be related to the structure and design of dockside monitoring. So whether dealers or vessels would pay for dockside monitoring, whether to allow lower coverage levels of dockside monitoring for certain ports or vessels, and how fish hold inspections would be handled. And it's as its preferred alternative, the council selected a no action. So to continue there would not be a dockside monitoring requirement for the entire fishery, but there would still be the option that sectors could voluntarily create a dockside monitoring program. And then as noted on the previous slide, dockside monitoring is a component of the maximized retention model of electronic monitoring. And the advisors recommended no action for dockside monitoring as well. Next slide, please, Sherry. So finally, looking at some of the alternatives that relate to overall for both ATSI monitoring and potential dockside monitoring, and in section 4.6 of the alternatives in the document, these are decisions that the council would make once it's established what the ATSI monitoring and a potential dockside monitoring program would look like, could consider whether there are certain vessels fishing in certain conditions that should be removed or should be exempted from these monitoring program requirements. So the no action here would continue to maintain any of the current exemptions from ATSI monitoring coverage, That's the extra large mesh gill net exemption for vessels that are fishing in the Broadstock areas 2 and 4. And then these two options here, option 2 and then option 3, which each have a sub option for at-sea monitoring and then also dockside monitoring. So if a vessel is fishing west of those, on a trip that occurs exclusively west of those lines, they would not be subject to at-sea or dockside monitoring. So just having MEFOP coverage. And the preliminary preferred alternative selected here was the option 3, which is west of 7130 west longitude to remove the monitoring requirements for vessels fishing west of that line. And then also within the section, there is an alternative that was selected as a preferred alternative that would establish a review process that would occur for vessels that are exempted from monitoring requirements to verify that groundfish catches continue to be low on these trips. The advisors selected all of the preferred alternatives, preliminary preferred alternatives in this section, and recommended those as well. And then finally, sort of found throughout the document, throughout the alternatives, are administrative measures that might relate to administration of at-sea monitoring or dockside monitoring or both. And so there's a section on considering the timing of coverage levels that's found within section 4.1. This really applies mostly to the no action or any variable coverage rate. So you'll see there weren't any preferred alternatives selected here. It's not really applying in the cases of fixed coverage levels. There's a section within 4.1.4 to establish a review process for the at-sea coverage level. I was selected as a preferred alternative by the council and also recommended by the advisors. A section in 4.1 as well related to adding a couple of items to the list that could be considered in a framework. That would be any new sector monitoring tools that become available in the future, and then vessel-specific coverage levels. This was a preferred alternative and then recommended by the advisors as well. Section 4.3 related to administration as far as establishing or allowing the RIA authority to streamline sector reporting. No preferred alternatives in this section, and it wasn't discussed by the advisors either. And then a section 4.4, which looks at funding and operational provisions. There are a couple of sub options here. As a preferred alternative of sub option 2B, this would allow waivers from monitoring requirements if NIMS did not have its shoreside funding in place. This was a preliminary preferred alternative as well as recommended by the advisors. And then sub option 2A in the section, which was not a preliminary preferred alternative, but was recommended by the advisors. This would allow the coverage to potentially be higher if NIMS had additional funding available. And then there's also within the dockside monitoring program, some alternatives related to administration of a dockside monitoring program. Next slide, please, Sherry. So now that was hopefully a quick review of some of the alternatives and focusing on the preliminary preferred alternatives that were selected back in January. Next, I'll be going through the summary of public comments. So the comment period ran beginning in March 20th, and ran through August 31st. As I'm sure everyone recalls, the council extended the comment period a number of times and tried to adjust as it adapted to the COVID-19 pandemic and rescheduled final action for Amendment 23 from June to September. So this can be found as for your documents, document 3E, which is the PDT summary of the public comments, and then a couple of additional documents within that, E1 and E2 being the collection of the meeting summaries for all of the public hearings, and then the all of the written comments that were received. Next slide, please, Sherry. So shown here just is an overview of the public hearings. So there were 9 public hearings total. 8 of those were held by webinar, of course, due to the COVID-19 pandemic. And then the very last one was held as an in-person hearing. This was the council's first ever outdoor meeting that was held under a tent at the Sheraton Wakefield. This was in Wakefield, Massachusetts. So the council staff tried to provide a lot of outreach to stakeholders and trying to adjust and adapt to the webinar format. But there were still some concerns from some of the industry of not being able to participate. And so the council looked into whether it would be possible to hold a hearing outdoors that would follow the COVID-19 guidance on public gatherings and was able to do so. And so you'll see throughout all of the 9 webinars, there were 154 unique attendees. So lots of people, several people attended almost all of the hearings. Lots of people attended 2 or 3 of them. There were a total of 51 comments with 40 unique speakers. So about half of the people that spoke at the in-person hearing in Wakefield had previously spoken on one of the webinars. You can see the attendance was highest at the first hearing. Probably not surprising, that was the hearing that followed the council meeting, so lots of people stayed on the webinar for that hearing. And then the attendance sort of slowed after that, with higher attendance at some of the later hearings. In particular, you'll see on July 30th and then August 10th. For those hearings, these were held by webinar, but there were some listening sessions that were held by different organizations. So Northeast Seafood Coalition on July 30th, and then August 10th, Maine Department of Marine Resources hosted a forum for fishermen to come and listen and give their comments on the webinar. So the council appreciates their efforts to try to help with getting fishermen who were not comfortable with the webinar format and making sure they were able to comment. And then the highest number of speakers we've seen at the final in-person hearing, and the attendance there shown is actually about half of those attendees were actually in person. We did have a listen-only option for those on the webinar as well. Next slide, please, Sherry. So shown here is an overview of all of the public comments, so both comments received at the public hearings as well as any of the written comments. There were 51 written comments. I will note this is a correction to what's shown in the summary of public comments in some of the earlier presentations. So shown here, there were a couple of comments that had gotten missed. We weren't able to open them, but they've been added to the total now, and we'll expect to revise that summary at a later time for the record. So there are 51 written comments as well as 51 comments received at the public hearings for a total of across 219 individuals or people representing organizations. So these were comments received from individuals, a number of letters signed by multiple individuals, as well as comments and letters from organizations and governments. And so the PDT looked at all of the comments and assigned stakeholder types to different commenters and came up with 8 different stakeholder types shown in this figure. So the top commercial fishermen representing themselves or their businesses from the groundfish fishery, a couple of commenters who were representing other fisheries. These were the monkfish fishery, lobster fishery. All of those individuals indicated that they had previously fished in the groundfish fishery. Commenters who were seafood dealers or processors, commenters that were other interested public, representatives from governments. These were local and state governments, all from the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, NGOs that represented commercial fishery interests, NGOs representing environmental groups at the national and the regional level, and then groundfish sectors and sector managers. So sector managers who spoke on behalf of their groundfish sector members, as well as from their experience as sector managers. And so shown these different colored barcodes show the number of comments that were received at the public hearings only, some that were commenters provided comments both at the hearings as well as written comments, and then commenters that submitted written comments only. So you can see the majority of comments were received from commercial groundfish fishermen, as well as other interested members of the public. All of the commenters were from New England. Home state could be determined for almost all of the commenters. There were a few that were unknown, and then there were a group of commenters that couldn't be determined their home state, but could determine that they were from New England. This is excluding the form letters that were received. And among those commenters, most of them, they were primarily from Massachusetts. There were 3 form letters that were received. So one, which was organized by Conservation Law Foundation, was submitted by 1,430 people. Of those, an additional, 83 of those people provided additional personal comments. And then there were 2 different industry form letters or industry comment cards that were received, submitted collectively by 211 people. So 166 people submitted was referred to as the off-course form letter, and then 45 submitted an industry comment card. Of the form letters, the one submitted by 1,430 people, those represented 38 states, most were from New England and mostly from Massachusetts. And then for the industry form letters, those were also mostly from New England, with the majority from Massachusetts. Next slide, please, Sherry. So shown here, this is covered in the summary of public comments, just pulling out some of the examples of, across the range of comments that were provided from commenters who were offering general support for taking action in Amendment 23. So these commenters felt that Amendment 23 would address the need for timely and accurate information on catch and discards in order to manage the fishery sustainably. Many of them cited the groundfish plan development team's work on observer bias that shows that the assumptions of the current monitoring program are invalid, so the coverage levels have not been sufficient to account for all catch in the fishery. A number of commenters were concerned about fairness and equitability of the current monitoring program, feeling that low levels of monitoring have allowed for misreporting and illegal discarding to occur, which they felt is unfair to anyone who is following the rules. These commenters felt that Amendment 23 would address the need for increased flexibility in the groundfish monitoring program in allowing sectors to use electronic monitoring in place of human SE monitors, which they also felt should help to lower the monitoring costs. And then commenters also felt that Amendment 23 would provide long-term benefits to the fishery through improved monitoring of catches, as in one commenter's words, the cycle of using flawed data to produce flawed assessments has led to a long-term failure of the fishery to reach its full potential. Next slide, please, Sherry. So shown here, again, found in the summary of public comments, just some of the range of comments provided for those who offered general support for taking no action on Amendment 23. So these commenters felt that the current monitoring program does sufficiently provide the information that's needed to manage the fishery. Many were concerned about the cost of additional monitoring not being sustainable for the fishery, and specifically concerned that if these higher levels of monitoring coverage were industry funded or industry was responsible for the cost of, would particularly be an issue and be difficult for smaller vessels and day boats, and could threaten their viability as well as threaten fleet diversity. Many of these commenters were concerned about the utility of dockside monitoring and some of the issues with the previous program, so they did support no action on dockside monitoring. And many of these commenters felt that the action wouldn't address problems with dock assessments, and they didn't feel that the action had enough support, that the higher cost of monitoring imposed in the industry would have any benefits to science to sustain fish stocks or improve livelihoods for fishing. Next slide, please, Sherry. There were also comments that were received that didn't offer specific support for taking no action, but were offering or just generally opposing the action. So commenters that felt that Amendment 23 wasn't addressing the issues that they saw or concerns about the process to develop Amendment 23. These commenters felt that the action doesn't meet its purpose need, feeling that there is there's no attempt been made to relate the additional cost of monitoring to any benefits to the fishery for any of the alternatives. Some commenters were concerned that Amendment 23, rather than focusing on its original intended purpose of developing an efficient and accurate monitoring program, is focused on trying to catch the next Carlos Rafael, feeling like the action was related to the issues caused by Carlos Rafael in the fishery. There were also commenters that, again, as noted earlier, concerned about costs of monitoring. This would force many fishermen out of business, threaten fleet diversity. They felt the council should start over in developing alternatives that consider this economic condition of the vessels that remain in the fleet. And then several commenters also felt that Amendment 23 should be put on hold or taken up later due to the current pandemic, where the fishery is dealing with some of the fears of COVID-19 and low prices at the dock due to the economic impacts from COVID-19. Next slide, please, Sherry. So shown here on the left are the alternatives, mostly focusing on the preliminary preferred alternatives, as well as some of the other alternatives that did receive a number of comments. And then on the right, as shown, the number of comments that were offered in support of these different alternatives, both those offered at public hearings and then those as written comments, So perhaps not surprisingly, most of the comments or the alternatives that received the most comments were some of the preliminary preferred alternatives, including sub-option 2D in the sector monitoring standards section, which is 100% monitoring of sector trips. And I believe that was partly why the council selected this option as preferred in January. I was hoping to get a lot of public input on this option, as well as option 2 and 3 in the sector monitoring tools section, which is the audit model and the maximized retention model. And there were also comments on the establishing a review, coverage rate review, no action for dockside monitoring, establishing the management uncertainty, or eliminating the management uncertainty buffers, and then some of the options to consider removing monitoring requirements. So in the next slides, I'll be walking through a number of comments in support, in some cases in opposition to some of these specific alternatives, focusing on, again, the preliminary preferred alternatives, as well as any of the other alternatives that did have higher numbers of comments. Some of the sections here, or some of the sections and alternatives, really received very little comments. So for example, in the sector monitoring standards, comments were either on option 2, the fixed coverage of as a percentage of trips, and then the no action. There were no comments received on option 3, which is looking at a fixed percentage of catch and those different sub-options. And very few comments received on some of the sections, like setting a time certain for knowing the coverage level, the additional items for the framework, and then sector reporting. Next slide, please, Sherry. So looking at comments that were received for this is in the sector monitoring standards 4.1.1 section of alternatives, no action. So that is to continue maintaining using the CV standard to set coverage. So 9 comments were offered in support of this. These were mostly from commercial groundfish fishermen and industry organizations. And so some of the rationale they provided for supporting no action, they felt industry can't afford higher levels of coverage, so needs coverage to remain at the status quo. And then some commenters felt that there were the projection that increased monitoring would lead to better, healthier fishery or better stock assessments hasn't been proven, citing some of the other fisheries in the Northeast that have lower levels of monitoring, as well as some of the issues that have continued to occur with the groundfish stock assessments. Next slide, please, Sherry. So very few comments were received on sub-options 2A, which is 25% monitoring, 2B at 50% monitoring, and then 2C at 75% monitoring. A couple of comments did support 25% monitoring sub-option 2A. Their rationale was similar to no action, which is perhaps not surprising given that 25% falls within the range of the coverage levels that have been seen under no action. And so these commenters again felt that there wasn't evidence that higher levels of monitoring would benefit the fishery, and they were concerned about industry being able to afford monitoring levels higher than 25%. There were a few comments that did support 50% monitoring. One fishing organization supported 50% monitoring or sub-option 2B if industry would become responsible for the cost of monitoring, otherwise supporting sub-option 2D, which is 100% monitoring, if federal funds continued to be available for reimbursing costs. And then no comments were specifically offered in support of sub-option 2C, which is 75% monitoring, although one comment from a groundfish business, it's a processor that owns groundfish vessels, did recommend the council consider some of the trade-offs between the cost and accuracy of the catch information that's provided by 75% coverage versus 100% coverage, so perhaps considering a coverage level between those two options. There were several comments that opposed any of the coverage levels options besides sub-option 2D, 100% monitoring. So these felt that setting coverage levels below 100%, even at 75%, would continue to perpetuate inaccurate catch monitoring and fail to ensure compliance with catch limits. These commenters were mainly environmental organizations. They felt that the loss of accuracy going to 75% coverage would not be worth the relatively small decrease in the costs. And then with 50% coverage, we're concerned, and citing some of the analysis in the draft Amendment 23 document, suggesting that this may exacerbate some of the issues that have occurred with the current program, given high incentives to potentially misreport, but less of an opportunity to do so. Next slide, please, Sherry. And so with sub-option 2D, 100% monitoring of sector trips, as the preliminary preferred alternative, did receive the most comments, 17 comments offered supporting this, with 31 comments that specifically opposed 100% monitoring. So for those who supported this option were a mix of commercial brown fish fishermen and their organizations, environmental organizations, as well as general interested public. Some of the rationale offered, they felt 100% monitoring is the only option to completely achieve the goals of Amendment 23, and specifically citing it as the only option that could completely remove the potential for bias. Some commenters noted they felt that 100% was necessary, given that the council had established a quota management and catch share system back in 2010 under Amendment 16, but didn't feel have what they felt was adequate accountability at the time. Many of these comments, commenters that did support 100% monitoring recognized the concerns about the costs and the ability of the fishery to and the fleet to absorb these costs. So they recommended that there be a process that's put in place to help transition the responsibility of costs from NIMS to the industry. Several commenters encouraged the council to try to take advantage of the federal appropriations that are available now to cover the cost of 100% monitoring. For commenters who were specifically opposed to 100% coverage, these were mostly commercial groundfish fishery fishermen and their industry organizations. Commenters were generally very concerned about costs and the industry's ability to afford really any higher levels of coverage, but specifically 100% coverage, and particularly concerned about impacts on smaller vessels and day boat operations. And concerned that this could further consolidate the fleet and reduce fleet diversity. There were also commenters who were concerned about operational challenges to achieving 100% coverage and having enough observers or EM equipment available to put on all vessels. Some comments note about impacts on crew operations when having 100% coverage and concerns about what impacts would be on potentially on the seafood product quality. And commenters feeling that there wasn't support or evidence in the document to support 100% or higher coverage levels. There were also several commenters that did support 100% monitoring, but only if federal reimbursements continued to pay for the coverage. Next slide, please, Sherry. So the next section of alternatives, looking at public comments received on the sector monitoring tools, section 4.1.2 of the alternatives, comments were received on all three of the options. So option one, this is the electronic monitoring in place of at-sea monitors at whatever coverage level is selected. Seven commenters supported this. These were mostly commercial groundfish fishermen, feeling that this option should be available to anyone who could demonstrate a lack of bias between their observed and unobserved trips. Concerns that if the coverage level selected were less than 100, this might disincentivize fishermen from using electronic monitoring, as the audit model and the maximized retention model are run on 100% of trips. There were commenters specifically opposing this option, mostly environmental organizations. They felt that this model of electronic monitoring was specifically put in place to help develop electronic monitoring in the fishery, but it was not intended to be statistically reliable. It shouldn't be an option moving forward. For sector monitoring tools option two, this is the audit model. Received a number of comments offering support from both commercial groundfish fishermen and their industry organizations and environmental organizations and general interested public, feeling that this option is a proven EM tool that can be used to provide high quality information and help reduce the cost of monitoring. Should be noted there were comments received from some of the commercial fishermen and organizations that participate in some of the electronic monitoring projects with the audit model, who still supported option two, but wanted the council to be aware that this option does, or this model of EM has taken a long time to develop, a lot of issues to be worked through, even just installing the equipment on vessels can take time, so they wanted the council to be aware of that, and that's captured in the summary of public comments. Option three, which is the maximized retention model, received about 14 comments that supported it. These were, again, a mix of commercial groundfish fishermen in their organizations, environmental organizations, and general interested public who also felt that this was an option. A proven EM technology that can help provide high quality information and reduce costs of monitoring over the long term. There were also comments that specifically opposed option three. These were mostly commercial groundfish fishermen. They were concerned that there was this program is in an earlier testing phase. It hasn't been operating as long as the audit model and may not be suitable for a large number of vessels in the fleet at this time. And so they were concerned that it was an option in the document. There may not be enough. They didn't feel there was enough information available to determine if it would be operational for a large number of vessels and whether it would help with reducing cost monitoring. Next slide, please, Sherry. So looking at some of the another section of alternatives within section 4.1 on sector monitoring, revisions looking at establishing a coverage rate review. There were no comments that selected and or offered support for no action. So all the comments received were in support of establishing a review rate, a mix of commercial groundfish fishermen, industry organizations, and environmental organizations, feeling it's important for a monitoring program to have a review to determine if it's meeting the program goals, as well as some of the commenters citing their experience in other catch share fisheries that have had higher levels of coverage. And then after several years, established a review process, reviewing the baseline of information and been able to use that to bring down their coverage while still achieving the goals of accuracy of their catch estimates. Comments received, this is a section of the alternatives a little later in the document, 4.4 on the funding and operational provisions. Comments mostly received on the preliminary preferred alternative 2B, which is to allow waivers for monitoring if NIMS doesn't have its shoreside costs. Comments and support were from mostly commercial groundfish fishermen, as well as some environmental organizations feeling that this option is important to maintain some of the flexibility in case there are changes in funding for at-sea monitoring. Next slide, please, Sherry. So comments that were received on dockside monitoring, which is section 4.2 of the alternatives. About 8 comments were received in support of the council's preferred alternative of no action on dockside monitoring. These were a mix of commercial groundfish fishermen and their organizations and a few environmental groups. Many of the commercial fishermen spoke from their experience with the previous program, felt that this didn't provide any benefits and was a lot of time and money and effort. And also felt that there might be other ways to address any concerns about vertically integrated companies rather than 100% dockside monitoring. There were comments received in support of option 2, which is to establish dockside monitoring program for the entire commercial fishery from both groundfish business that owns groundfish vessels and its processor, as well as environmental groups. Who felt that dockside monitoring is needed to verify vessel catch and that without full dockside monitoring, this can lead to monitoring loopholes, and also feeling that dockside could be an important part of establishing accountability and being paired with some of the initial development of electronic monitoring on the at-sea side of things. Next slide, please, Sherry. So looking at the management uncertainty buffers section of alternatives, 4.5, looking first at the preferred alternative of option 2 to eliminate the buffers. This is only if 100% coverage is chosen. So about 13 comments offered support across environmental organizations and commercial fishermen and industry organizations, feeling that this option can give industry a benefit of the reduced uncertainty that could come with improved at-sea monitoring. Should be noted, it's captured in the summary of public comments, that there were comments from some commercial fishermen and industry organizations that while still supporting or not necessarily opposing option 2, they didn't feel that eliminating the buffers would really provide much help for the fishery, and that having the additional 3 to 5% of catch for certain stocks wouldn't be of much benefit, as they likely would not be able to catch the additional catch given some of the low utilization of those stocks. As far as support received for no action on the management uncertainty buffers alternative, there were 5 comments, mostly from environmental organizations, that they felt that while high levels of coverage can help reduce management uncertainty, it won't completely remove it. There's still going to be unobserved toes, potential for misreporting. And so feeling that the management uncertainty needs to remain in place. Next slide, please, Sherry. Finally, looking at comments received on the last section of alternatives, which is 4.6, looking at potential exemptions or removing vessels from monitoring coverage. So all comments were received either on the preferred alternatives of suboptions 3A and 3B or the no action. There were no comments received on option 2A and 2B. So for comments supporting option 3A and 3B, this is the line is 7130 West Longitude. Mostly commercial groundfish fishermen and industry organizations. They felt that this option recognizes that the ground fishing that occurs in southern New England is very different from ground fishing in other regions, that these are mostly vessels and trips that are directed on other non-ground fish stocks but are using a ground fish day at sea. So they are subject to monitoring, but there's very little ground fish catcher or ground fish bycatch on those trips. There were comments received offering support for no action in this section, mostly from environmental organizations and some commercial fishermen. So they felt that there should be no additional exemptions established at this time, given, referencing the draft amendment 23 document and recognizing that the current information in the monitoring program is flawed and not accurate, and feeling that establishing exemptions at this time would be inappropriate and premature, and instead a monitoring program should be established, and then exemptions could be evaluated a couple years from now. As well as some commenters felt that no vessels should be exempt from monitoring requirements if they catch overfished stocks. Next slide, please, Sherry. So those were comments that were offered on specific alternatives. There were comments that were offered that the PDT tried to categorize into other sections shown here. So a number of comments that were received on the DEIS, I've just shown a couple of examples here. There are more examples pulled out in the summary public comments, and then of course can be found throughout the written comments and the public hearing meeting summaries. So some of these were concerns about some of the cost analysis assumptions, concerns with the electronic monitoring alternatives and the analyses, and again, specifically with maximized retention, feeling that this option is not ready. It's still in a testing phase and shouldn't have been an option in the document. There were comments offered from in about 15 comments. These were one example shown here is a comment that suggested to modify one of the alternatives and put a sunset clause into 100% coverage, that would reduce the rate back to 50% should the federal funds run out. There were a couple of comments that offered some additional alternatives that are not currently considered in Amendment 23. Some of these were related to observer operations, so recommending deploying two observers on trip boats so that all hauls would be observed, or eliminating the use of volume-to-volume method. A number of comments recommending the council look at better management groundfish discards that occur in other fisheries, and some that were specifically referenced for the common pool and the lobster fisheries. And then finally, there were comments offered and a handful of comments that kind of fell into a category of other ideas for looking at sector management. For example, recommending the council look at better utilizing the sort of self-policing and co-management nature of the sectors to help address issues with monitoring and increase some of the enforcement of the existing monitoring requirements. Next slide, please, Sherry. So next part of the presentation here, just an overview, an update on some additional analyses that's related to Amendment 23. So this was an analysis that was contracted by the council beginning last fall with Dr. Lisa Kerr at GMRI and her collaborators. And then it was initially presented to the groundfish advisors in the committee as the work was getting underway, explaining that this work would sort of be running parallel to the development of the Amendment 23 DEIS, the attempt that it would become available for the public during public comment, and then incorporating as an analysis into the final draft Amendment 23 document. So next slide, please. And also the Groundfish Committee received the next couple of slides here were part of a presentation they received, providing an overview of the work prior to a review that occurred by a subpanel of the SSC. So this is a draft report you have. This is document 3F, I believe, that's entitled Evaluating the Impact of Inaccurate Catch Information on the New England Groundfish Management. So the council again contracted Dr. Lisa Kerr and collaborators at GMRI, asking this question as it relates to Amendment 23. You know, how does underreported catch that occurs in the commercial groundfish fishery affect assessments and catch advice? That was a question that certainly came about in looking at Amendment 23 and looking at improvements to monitoring and evaluating some of the issues with the current monitoring program, wondering how any underreported catch occurs, what impacts those might be on both the stock assessments and the management process. And so this work uses simulation testing to test a range of underestimated catch scenarios and again evaluating the impact on the performance of both stock assessment and management. And these simulations were conditioned to be similar to the Gulf of Maine cod stock and its assessment and management. So it's important to note this work is really serving to isolate underestimated catch and its impacts. So it's not looking, or it's not designed to inform other questions such as, is the current catch data biased, or what is the cause of any biased or bad catch data? It's also not considering other uncertainties that occur in science and management, such as bad survey data or imprecise recreational catch or inaccurate stock assessment assumptions. Next slide, please, Sherry. So just quickly to show the summary of the report findings, this slide was also shown, shared with the Groundfish Committee at their update last month, as well as at the SSC review panel meeting that occurred. And so for the management performance, the simulations ran a couple of different scenarios, one looking at constant catch bias in terms of bias from underestimated catches, and then another scenario that looked at a change point in catch bias where there's assumed to be no catch bias, and then a change in which catch bias is introduced that was informed by some of the PDT's monitoring analyses that were reviewed last year looking at discard incentives. And so so the findings show that estimated stock status was similar to the true stock status determinations under the constant catch scenarios, constant catch bias scenarios. But then when the change point in catch bias is introduced, this exhibited instances of misperception of stock status. And some of the overall conclusions presented by the work, improvement of catch reporting has the potential to improve stock assessment and management performance can contribute to achieving rebuilding plans. Some of the high to extreme bias in catch reporting is detrimental to sustainable management. And so some of the lower catch bias levels, less than 50%, have more limited impacts on assessment and management performance in the context of risk adverse management. Although as noted by the SSC review panel, even at some of these lower catch bias levels, there's still concerns about unintended overfishing and substantial discarding that occurs. Next slide, please, Sherry. So following receipt of the draft report, there was a subpanel of the SSC that reviewed this work on August 21st. The reviewers were John Wiedenman, who's the review chair, and Chris LaGault and Michael Wilbert. And their terms of reference are shown here. They were charged with evaluating whether the methods of the work were adequately described and based on sound analytic techniques and statistical principles, looking at whether important uncertainties were identified and whether the impacts of those uncertainties on the analyses were described, considering some of the strengths and weaknesses of the approach, whether the conclusions are supported by the results, and whether there are any recommendations for improvement, and whether the conclusions provide information that is relevant for the council to consider. Next slide, please, Sherry. And then I should say, so this review panel report is attached to the draft report that you have as document, I believe it's 3F. And so generally the reviewers found that the work meets the terms of reference, that the methods are based on sound analytic techniques and are described adequately, that a number of the uncertainties have been identified, and that the conclusions are supported by the results. They felt that one of the strengths of the work is using the simulation modeling approach and being able to isolate underestimated catch factor to test, as well as using the actual ASAP assessment model for the Gulf of Maine cod stock. They did have a number of recommendations, both that fall into the short-term recommendations. Short-term recommendations are some that it's expected that Dr. Kerr and her team planning to incorporate into the final version of the report. So some of their suggestions from the reviewers are sharing some additional clarifications of some of the methods descriptions, some of the equations that are shown, some additional caveats and some of the conclusions. Again, as noted on a previous slide, even at some of the lower bias levels, the reviewers felt that there's still, more limited impacts on assessment and management performance, there's still some concerns about continued overfishing could be noted. They suggested providing additional clarification on the scope of the work. So noting that this work is really intended with answering the question or asking and answering the question of what are the impacts of underestimated or underreported catch on assessment and management performance. And it's not testing impacts of improvements in reporting. That may be a recommendation for future work and longer term recommendation. It suggested providing additional details for the different catch bias levels that were chosen to test in the model. They recommended assigning so that the model, the work shows both the MRAMP results for the Gulf of Maine cod stock assessment, as well as the other assumption of M equals 0.2. And they felt that to streamline the results and focus on just the M equals 0.2 results and move the MRAMP results to an appendix to help your readership of the report. They also recommended considering calculating some additional performance measures such as probability of biomass dropping below a certain threshold or the probability of overfishing that would just further describe some of the results and conclusions. Next slide, please, Sherry. The reviewers did have some long-term recommendations. So these would be more future work considerations. They recommended increasing the number of model iterations just further to get some further clarification on some of the uncertainty towards the end of the model runs, including retrospective adjustments when setting catch advice, potentially exploring additional change points in the catch bias. Again, that idea when bias could be reduced in the future to mimic the impact of additional monitoring coverage into the future. And then potentially exploring an earlier start for that initial change point in the catch data and the bias in the catch data. So what are the next steps for the work? So Dr. Kerr and her team will incorporate the SSC review panel's recommendations, the short-term recommendations that are designed to provide some additional clarification or explanation rather than methods or some of the uncertainties and some of the conclusions. And then the final report will be sent to the council. And then the plan would be for the final report to be incorporated into Amendment 23, the final Amendment 23 document as an additional appendix, as an additional supporting analysis. Next slide, please, Sherry. So one more slide to go through. The plan development team held a meeting a couple days ago. That was a follow-up after the follow-up discussion to occur after the recent groundfish committee meeting held last week. And the PDT felt that they could they met to discuss and try to provide some clarification to a number of recurring questions or points that came up both during the public comments as well as in some of the discussions that occurred by the groundfish advisors and the groundfish committee last week. And so these were a number of items that can be identified in a memo that the PDD provided as, I think this is document 3I that you have on items. Again, these were recurring questions that came up on some of the analyses related to the economic impacts analysis and some of the other analyses, including, for example, questions about the electronic monitoring review rates that were used, how cost estimates the document could compare to actual realized costs once the program monitoring program is implemented, questions about looking at net revenue and a break-even analysis to understand impacts, wondering whether the fixed coverage levels have been evaluated against the purpose and need, understanding how increased revenues could occur in the fishery with the increased levels of monitoring, if there are any predictions about vessels that might exit the fishery as a result of higher monitoring, clarifications on work that was done to look at Google for MainCod multiplier work, sort of looking at an upper bound of potential missing discards that could occur from misreporting. And so these were points that the PDT felt it could either provide clarification, point to sections in the DEIS where those questions and points had been addressed, maybe could explain those a little more. In some cases, commenters were requesting information, sort of pulling from a couple of different analyses, and the PDT shows as an example how it could display that information in a way to show impacts on different components or different communities within the groundfish fishery. As an example that could be provided as an addition to the final draft Amendment 23 document. There were also requests or interests from some commenters and some of the comments looking at particular analyses. And the PDT notes that in some cases the information is just is not available to conduct those analyses. So just pointing that out in the memo that's provided. Next slide, please, Sherry. So after all of that, the council's charge for today is to discuss the public comments that were received on draft Amendment 23 and to make a recommendation on the final preferred alternatives. Next slide, Sherry. So I'll just leave this figure here to kind of show again the overall decision tree to help think about those decision points to be made today regarding changes to the monitoring program, to look at improving catch accounting, so program consideration of changes to at-sea monitoring, both the monitoring standard, additional tools, and whether to eliminate the buffers, considering dockside monitoring, and then a lot of the other decisions sort of fall underneath those decisions relate to both of those programs. So with that, I will turn it back over to the chair and see if we have any questions on the presentation. Thank you.
Excuse me. Thank you very much, Ms. Friede. I'm happy to report that Chairman Alexander is back online. So how we're going to proceed here is I'm going to supervise the asking of questions and questions only on this presentation, and I'm going to turn it back over to Chairman Alexander, and we will start going through the decision document. So with that, I will entertain any questions from the council members on the presentation. Okay, we'll start with Mr. Tracy.
The question of if a fisherman were to choose the EM option and the council were to choose something less than 100%, how would that flow through to the EM operation? Would those cameras operate based on the percentage, or what are the logistics of that, just to clarify?
Ms. Friede.
Thanks, Mr. Tracy, for the question. So for the three EM options, the first one, option one, that's the only option where the camera would only run on that whatever percentage of coverage that is selected, it would run on that percentage of trips. For the audit model and the maximized retention model, the way those operate is the camera's on 100% of the time. So that would be, regardless of what the fixed coverage level would be chosen, that it's sort of like it meets or exceeds that coverage level. And the intent with both the audit model and maximized retention model and what the council feels is something they found valuable with those options is that with running the camera on 100% of the time should reduce or eliminate the potential for bias. With the audit model, there would be a review rate that's determined, and there's some guidance that's been provided by the agency as to what is expected. Those review rates might start out at generally looking at higher review, so a higher portion of the video that's reviewed sort of initially in the program development or as fishermen are new to using the audit model, and then as sort of the fishing handling practices improve, and the information improves, those review rates would be expected to decrease. And that may be similar for the maximized retention model. So I hope that answers that question there.
That does. Thank you. But so just to clarify, though, regardless of the coverage level that's chosen by the council, those who choose EM would be subject, would be running 100% of the time on their trips.
If the for the audit model and the maximized retention model, if the option one, which is the sort of one-to-one replacement, were to be, which is not currently a preferred alternative, but that would be more similar to what you're suggesting. So if the coverage level, for example, is 50%, then the camera would only run on the 50% of the trips. Just sort of different operations for those different models of electronic monitoring.
Gotcha. All right. Thank you very much.
Okay. Lineup's going to be Salerno, Etri, Sissonwine. So Mr. Salerno.
Thank you, Dr. Chairman. I have a couple different questions. I don't know if you want me to give them all at once, or should I kind of like pony back in the line once I kind of get across one question, set of questions?
How about two questions now, and then we'll let somebody else ask.
I get you. Okay, thank you. Robin, so as to some of the public comments you received talking about the self-policing type co-management nature of potential monitoring tools, was there any discussion at the committee GAP or even the council level of exploring, you know, using the sectors as they were intended to do, such as giving them additional information to kind of go through this self-policing process?
Yeah, thanks for your question. I don't believe that the specific discussion came up at the most recent set of advisory or committee meetings, but I do think that's at least been discussed at some of the advisory panel meetings in the past, some interest in, you know, sort of, is there maybe a different approach to looking at some of the monitoring issues that have occurred and allowing, you know, sectors to sort of take on that role that they were intended to help, you know, self-police or look into some of their individual members. So I don't think it came up at recent meetings. I could be mistaken, but I think it has been discussed somewhat in some of the past advisory panel meetings and maybe the committee as well.
Okay, thank you. My second question actually has to do with the Kerr et al. Work. You know, and I went through the paper. I kind of, you know, I went through what the SSC's report on it was. And understanding that the report was looking at miss and catch, but could that actually just be defined as missing removals from the stock, where we could be talking as, you know, missing catch from the groundfish fishery or missing catch from, you know, other fisheries, or to tell you the truth, missing natural mortality that we can't account for at this point? I mean, I guess my question is, couldn't we frame that as it could be any one of those, or and maybe a combination of all three, and wouldn't that still produce similar results regardless of what we're calling this missing catch component?
So the DIS does acknowledge, you know, there are other sources of potential you know, uncertainty or missing potential missing catch, other components, other fisheries that catch groundfish, or just other aspects, as you noted, natural mortality assumptions. But the sort of the focus that the council chose in looking at Amendment 23 is addressing improving catch accounting for the commercial groundfish fishery. And a number of those analyses supportive that are looking at specifically, you know, what are the impacts of inaccurate or missing catches from the commercial component. So it is acknowledged, I think, that there are potential other sources of uncertainty, but that's not the focus that the council defined for Amendment 23 and looking at improvements to commercial groundfish monitoring. Because it's, I guess it should be noted, it's both looking at improvements of inaccuracy of catch estimates, and then also looking at the catch accounting side of the sector program and wanting to improve, make sure that accurate accountability is occurring of catches to make sure that ACLs are not exceeded.
All right, I see Dr. Cornan's hand up. She wants to contribute to a couple more pieces of information. Dr. Cornan.
Good morning. Yes,
back to Mr. Salerno's question about sectors and self-policing, self-management. Although the committee at this last meeting did not specifically discuss that with respect to the alternatives in Amendment 23, I will draw council members' attention to both the committee and the AP's motions that occurred on the 21st and the 22nd underneath the discussion about priorities for next year. There is a motion about reviewing the self-management aspects of the sector system within the next phase of a catch-year review. So that was the context of the discussion that Mr. Salerno may have recalled from those meetings, but not necessarily through the lens of the alternatives under consideration at present.
Thank you, Dr. Cornan.
Attorney Etri.
Thank you. Similar to Dan, I have a couple questions. If you want, can I do two? And then if I want, raise my hand again.
Sounds perfect.
Okay, thank you. So my first question is more just of a clarifying question from your presentation. I think it's reflected in motion 10 from the gap motion. With the comments that were received specific to max retentions, you know, especially those that were received predominantly from industry groups or industry members, is it a more accurate clarification to say that those that spoke against max retention spoke against it in the sense of it not being available at this time, so it's not truly realistic to look at it as a current tool to offset costs versus not being supportive of max retention as a tool in the future? Is that a more accurate clarification?
It is, thank you. Yeah, I'm sorry if it wasn't clear. That tried to capture those who weren't, most of those who were comments were opposed to max retention, just felt that it shouldn't be we're opposed to it being an option in the document because they didn't feel it's available right now at this time for the fleet to use, and not knowing when in the future it might be, since it's only been running a couple of years and the audit model's been running longer. So I think that is a good clarification. So thank you for that.
Thank you, Robin. I appreciate that. I realize synthesizing and putting it all into a bullet it's hard. You can miss some steps. So thanks for that clarification. My other question actually goes kind of a little bit follows up with what Dan had asked about the simulation work. I know that I've been asking some questions about the underlying data that was utilized within the simulation work. And I just want to, like, thinking about how this work and how it may or may not be coming up in future discussions today. My understanding, and I couldn't listen to the peer review, was that this SSC subpanel concluded that the method that the PDT used to derive magnitude of unreported catch, that there was no quantitative basis for the extreme bias scenario. So is it a fair way for us to really consider this scenario work, that any of the scenarios, you know, for the scenarios to be realistic or plausible, it's more accurate to just look at it as illustrative of the consequences of various types of assumptions about the magnitude of catch bias versus trying to correlate that to any of the decisions we're going to be making towards, you know, trying to link a benefit from Lisa's work towards a decision we're going to make this afternoon?
Sorry, I was trying to find my unmute button. Yes, so I think that it's, it'd be good to explain that the work in looking at the impacts of underreported catch on, what are those impacts on assessments and management performance, needed to test a range, or, you know, needed to look at a range of catch bias scenarios. And so through some sort of coordination with the PDT and trying to look at some, what it would be some realistic bounds to set. So I guess the goal is to set, you know, of course, zero bias being the minimum, and then looking at a potential upper range, not suggesting that that might be the actual upper range of bias that's occurred, but the PDT's work to sort of support that, try to look at, based on sort of a simple analysis, comparing conditions of one of the stocks of Copan Cod between a couple different time periods, what would be sort of a rough upper range of bias that could occur that would sort of be limited by the fishing effort that occurred in that the recent reference year compared to previous years. So I think in some of the early discussions of the work, and when the committee first received an overview of this report, you know, some advisors and committee members were recommending testing out much higher levels, and there was some discussion about how that might be difficult to even if that would just not work in the model. So this the work was designed to try to provide some sort of realistic bounds that could inform that question of what is underreported, underestimated catch from the commercial groundfish fishery look like in impacting the assessments and performance. And then as I didn't explain it, but Dr. Kerr did in her presentation to the committee in the review, she tried to sort of adjust that, recognizing that that is for the commercial component, and there are certainly other sources of potential bias or uncertainty. So it's designed to sort of be a tool to show to be used along with a number of the PDT's analyses that provide a lot of the underlying analyses in the Amendment 23 document, demonstrating what has occurred under the current monitoring program at the current coverage levels, and the issues of bias in terms of observed trips not representing unobserved, and how those that could impact the accuracy of catch estimates, and sort of showing that, trying to show some of the impacts on specifically on stock assessment and management performance. Hopefully that was a long explanation. I'm not sure.
If I may, just as a quick follow-up.
Yeah, very quickly, because we got
other people. Okay, thank you. So again, this is really just trying to wrap my head around this for later discussions. From what you just explained, it's probably a fair, summary to say that we can't use this analysis in and of itself to infer that any level of monitoring is going to achieve any level of accuracy in catch data. Because we don't have any sense of the magnitude of the bias, all we can really use this analysis for is to assess, scenarios about if misreporting is happening, here is the type of consequences, various ranges, but here's the type of consequences it could have on both assessments and management. But we can't use it by itself to infer a certain level of monitoring is going to achieve any type of accuracy with the data, correct?
Correct. I think it'd be more accurate to say this additional analysis used along with the analyses that are provided, other analyses in Amendment 23, which the PDT evaluates some of the different coverage levels and their impacts on improving catch accounting, and the sort of just add some additional analysis, additional support for that, and not specifically sort of evaluating each of those coverage levels, just sort of asking a more general question of how underestimated catch performance, or how that impacts assessment and management performance.
Dr. Sisson-Wine, and then Dr. McKenzie.
Thank you, and thanks for the presentation. I also have two questions. I think they're important, but I hope they're relatively quick. With respect to the GMRI study, or the Lisa Kerr study, I think the conclusion is that the system is actually quite robust, the system meaning performance of assessments and management, to bias in catch data, so long as the bias is consistent throughout the time series. And I think that's a conclusion that's actually widely known in the stock assessment world, but that the problem occurs when the degree of bias changes substantially, like 50%. First, is that also your interpretation of the results of the Kerr study? And if so, my first question then is, do we have any reason to think there has been a very large change or change of the order that's considered in these assessments in the level of bias resulting from things like observer bias and so on? So that's the first question. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Sisselwein. So yes, the referring back to the slide on some of the overview of the draft report from Dr. Kerr and GMRI, that did look at the two different sort of scenarios for bias. And yes, when as is, I think, as you demonstrated, is widely known, when bias is constant, there's less of an impact, less of a issue for assessments and management than when there's a change point in the bias. And the PDT tried to use some of its analyses to inform the timing of the change point. This is based on monitoring analyses that were reviewed by the peer review by the SSE last year, and specifically looking at some potential discard incentives that exist in the groundsel fishery, specifically a time period of around 2015, identified some potential incentives to. So there may be a strong incentive for bias or for misreporting to occur on some of the stocks. So that's where that change point was explored, or how that was informed. And I think one of the reviewers' suggestions was also even to look at possibly there are their earlier change point years to consider as well.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. There are reasons or arguments to be made that there is a change point around 2015, but you haven't actually cited evidence. And I was wondering whether in the various analyses that were conducted that did show evidence of an observer effect, any of those were sufficient to be able to identify the likelihood that there was a change point.
Yes, I can't recall entirely, but I believe from the review of that collection of PDT monitoring analyses that occurred last year on observer bias and the one being looking at discard incentives, it just suggests that for at least some of the stocks, like Gulf of Maine cod, around 2015 is a potential year of there could be additional incentives that could have caused high likely to cause a bias in the data, misreporting issues. Some of the other stocks, I think, should have some of the earlier years in the sector system may have had higher discards for those stocks.
I see Jamie's hand up. Maybe she wants to add
let
something.
Dr. Carnan add to that.
Thanks. Actually, Robin, you made one of the points that I was going to make. So thank you that work going back to the groundfish PDT's review of its analysis. Sorry, I'm getting some feedback. And I think another point is worth noting that's in the panel's report, Dr. Sissonwein, and that is on when they're summarizing the conclusion, are the conclusions supported by the results? And one of the points the panel made is that they were concerned with the conclusion that less than 50% underreporting has a small effect on management performance. They state that while it's true that this level of underreporting resulted in better outcomes than the higher levels of underreporting, it still resulted in unintended overfishing and a relatively substantial discarding. So there were still some management concerns that the peer review panel wanted to make the managers aware of that could occur even at lower levels of underreporting. But Robin's point about the 2015 as a possible change point was something that we did discuss with Kerr and others in developing their work and their scenario analyses.
Okay, that's fine. Thank you. That's helpful because I wasn't current on all of that information. So thank you. If I could go to the second point I wanted to make, or second question.
Yes,
and
yep.
So I note that we've looked at the issue of observer coverage using various metrics to set a target or a limit. The existing FFP basically says coverage should achieve a certain CV, 30%. And in this FMP or this proposed amendment, there's a consideration of setting coverage limit based on the number of trips and the amount of the catch, that is up to some percentage of catch or some percentage of the number of trips. Has there ever been a discussion or a consideration of setting coverage limit based on some level of reasonable cost, that is a percentage of X vessel value or something like that? Because it strikes me that the way we're doing it now essentially writes a blank check, whereas setting a coverage limit that takes into account cost actually imposes a very large incentive for efficiency. So that's my question. Has there been discussion within this process of Amendment 23 of basically having coverage limit somehow related to a cost level that's considered acceptable or economically viable? Thank you.
Thanks for the question. It's a good one. I can't recall any, I don't know if there were any specific discussions either in comments or any of the committee meetings. I think most of the discussion is focused on, you know, the CV method, and I should say a part of the SSC review of the monitoring analyses in concluding that the CV method is not appropriate for determining coverage in the groundfish program, given that observed the fundamental assumption that observed trips are not representative of unobserved trips, and moving towards more of a fixed rate of coverage is also something some of the industry supported, but just in terms of the, you know, sort of business planning aspect of just knowing the coverage every year. But as far as specifically considering monitoring coverage that's related to a proportion of costs, I'm not sure that I can recall that specifically has come up in any of the comments or discussions. I guess in terms of trying to achieve with the goal of trying to achieve accuracy of catch estimates, improving accountability, and considering, I guess, the impacts to consider how cost efficiency sort of works into that, and some of the benefits of higher coverage and more accurate catches in terms of in improving operations for the fishery overall.
I'm going to hop in here, and I see Dr. Cornan and Melissa Aaron's hand up to add some additional information on this. Dr. Cornan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of quick points. The current approach to setting coverage is certainly informed by the achieving a CV, but it's also, there are a number of additional steps that are used, including a multi-year approach to determine coverage rates, as well as looking at fishery performance criteria. This can include how much catch occurs by stock, as well as the status of the stock. So there's a little bit more to it than right at present that gets at the CP30 that tries to incorporate some measures of fishery performance with respect to what the coverage should be overall. Second, although the council's not spent as much time on this recently, we did talk about two different approaches that potentially could be related to cost. One of them is under the percentage catch. There was some discussion about, would the majority of catch of certain species or certain stocks be the focus? So those vessels that potentially are landing a greater value of groundfish or greater poundage of groundfish, presumably. And that's in the second section on how to drive the rate. And with respect to cost efficiency, there has been some discussion, although not at present one of the council's preliminary preferred, of having a dockside monitoring program and some of the merits of a savings to industry of monitoring things dockside rather than at sea. So those are the types of things that have been discussed, although not pursued as the council's preliminary preferred at the last meeting.
Well, thank you. I'd love to have an extended discussion of all this, but I'll stick to the question that I asked and you've answered it. So thank you very much.
I see Melissa Aaron's hand up to contribute, and then Dr. McKenzie after that. Melissa?
I think Jamie actually did a pretty good job of covering a lot of points. I would also just point Dr. Sissonwine to one of the appendices of the amendment, which is the cost efficiency analysis. And really the goal of that analysis was to look at all of the different monitoring tools, the EM options, as well as human coverage in meeting the same level of accuracy. And so that's the underlying purpose of that, is to look at what reductions in cost you might get from meeting the same level of accuracy and improvement in the monitoring coverage. And so analyses like that do get at that point. Thank you.
Dr. McKenzie.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had a couple of things that I wanted to ask, some of which has come up already. My questions about the Kerr report, I think, have been covered pretty well. I want to thank everyone for talking about that. But I also have a question now about how what we've determined about using CV as a coverage as an about the CV approach for setting coverage. And if I may, through you, Mr. Chairman, may I ask this question to Mike Pentney?
Sure.
Haven't we determined that the CV approach is deficient? If I recall, as we started talking about Amendment 23, that was one of the things that we wrestled with, that you know the current one had some deficiencies. So if I could ask the regional administrator to refresh our memories on that, that would be helpful. Thank you.
Mr. Pentney?
So my response, I guess, to the question is that, yes, based on the PDT analysis from a couple of years ago and the SSC's evaluation of that analysis, the conclusions, particularly of the SSC, is that the current monitoring system, which is based around a CV approach, is insufficient and is leading to, these problems associated with bias and unknown catch. So I think the answer to the question is yes, but I would have to refer specifically back to the PDT analysis and SFC review of that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Regional Administrator.
Thank you. All right, so we're gonna go, I don't see any of the hands up now. We're gonna go out to the audience for questions. And again, it's questions on the presentation. It's not to advocate for or against any of the coverage. That'll come up when we start down the motion process. But now, if there are any questions on the presentation that was just given. Mr. Gaethel.
Thank you, Chairman. My question is on a point that I've kept bringing up, and it still isn't in the summary of the public hearing information, and that's the biological cost of 100% monitoring or any level of monitoring. You're killing all these animals that are otherwise released alive, and I want to know why it's consistently not being put on the screen and why it's not being analyzed in the DEIS.
I see Dr. Cornan's hand went right up, so I'll let her try and answer that. Dr. Cornan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Gaethel, for your comment. We will acknowledge that the ground fish advisors, when they did meet, they made many motions. Mr. Gaethel made this motion, similar motion, with respect to this impact at that AP meeting, and it did pass the AP. The ground fish committee did, however, not take up that motion at their meeting. So if the council members want to refer to the groundfish AP motions, I'll dig out the exact motion number, but Mr. Gaethel is right. It did come up at an AP meeting. However, the committee did not specifically take up that motion, no vote either way, at their meeting the following day on the 22nd.
Okay, any other questions from the audience? I see none. I'm going to go back to Chairman Alexander is back. That concludes that presentation. What I thought I'd turn it over to Chairman Alexander, maybe for a few general remarks, and then we'll start down the decision document. I think what we'll do is we've been going now for an hour and 45 minutes, and I've been instructed to take frequent breaks. So why don't we hear from Chairman Alexander, take a 10-minute break, and then we will come back and start the motion process. Chairman Alexander.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair. Sorry about that incident. Good thing I got my disclaimer out just before that happened this morning when I lost my power, but I moved up to my brother's house and I'm up and running here now. So since our meeting in June, since the council meeting in June, the groundfish team has been very busy. We've had 6 public hearings. One of those hearings was an in-person under a tent hearing in Wakefield that I think, you know, the leadership of the council and the staff went above and beyond to listen to some of the criticisms that the public had been expressing to them. So, and I appreciate that, and I thank them for that. The PDT has met at least 6 times. The RAP has met, the GAP has met twice, and the Groundfish Committee have met twice. That's a whole lot of meetings during the summer to come up with what we have before you today. And you know, when it comes to Amendment 23, the monitoring options, I have no motions for you. And we met last week, whatever. Everything's running together to me here now. But we met after a particularly long GAP discussion the day before. The committee met the next day, and we spent most of the day discussing GAP motions. So although I have no motions for you, I think that people were preparing for this week, and hopefully we'll get some sort of motion when we start this process up. The way this is going to work, we're going to go through the decision document piece by piece, front to back, and hopefully at the end of the day we are going to make a final decision on Amendment 23, barring a total blackout in New England here. I think we should be able to get it done. So that's about what I have, Mr. Chair. So if you want to, whatever you'd like to do, if you want to entertain a motion, I'm ready. If you don't.
Yeah. Why don't I just said appreciate the opening remarks and kind of the history. I think it's important to the public and the other council members to understand there's been a lot of meetings going on around this. And I think today is decision time. So with that, I thought we'd take a break now so people can gather their thoughts before we start into the motion process. Why don't we stand in recess until 10:30?